Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion on politics, human rights, and the environment. I'm Dory Smith. Is Obama administration policy in the Mideast floundering because the propaganda war is derailing diplomatic opportunities?
He was told that if the U.S. stopped its combat operations, they could make peace with the Taliban within 6 months.
We speak with investigative historian and journalist Gareth Porter, author of the 2006 book Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and the Road to War in Vietnam. First, Pakistani journalist Muhammad Khurshid is in the Bajor Agency section of Pakistan, a tribal region situated on the Pakistan-Afghan border. Civilians there are in peril due to U.S. and Pakistani military attacks on militants and a growing number of suicide bombings. According to Khurshid, Pakistani leaders accept U.S. funding to target the militants, but mostly kill civilians.
Pakistani leader is playing double game with the U.S. leadership. On the one hand, they are getting dollars from the United States for the war against terrorism. But the fact is, they are killing only the innocent people. The leadership, they are still at large, and they have been giving away to these people.
Your March 17th story in Op-Ed News was titled, Who Killed Me and Why? And you were talking about an 11-year-old who died. He had been injured a month before in a suicide bombing at the Kar headquarters of the Bajor Agency. Just explain why his death hit you and others there very hard.
The death of Abu Bakr, he was a very cute boy. During his days in the hospital, he asked this question several times, yes, who has killed him and why? And when his body was brought for burial, interestingly, his eye opened, and I was feeling that he was asking this question from the whole world, as why I was killed and who is responsible? And this is very tragic, because in this operation against terrorism, no one is taking responsibility, and neither the government of Pakistan, the people don't know who are the terrorists, and this is a very, very difficult situation for the people of the whole region. The moment they are facing the horror and terror of the war, their children are being killed. According to the murder of Bajor Agency, tribal areas, and whole Pakistan, this is the duty and this is the obligation of the mothers of the whole world to come to the rescue and to kill their children to stop violence, because the violence is killing the innocent people.
What kinds of things do you think might work to help the situation to stop the violence?
The best solution is the contact between the people of the United States and Pakistan and the whole world, because the rulers have an interest in the war, but people have interest in peace. So there must be direct contact between the people of tribal area, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and the whole world. And this is the only way to a peaceful world.
We turn now to Gareth Porter, who is based in Washington, D.C. He has worked as both a scholar and journalist, going back to his time as a bureau chief in Saigon. He's author of four books and writes for Interpress Service on Iraq and Afghanistan and for many other news outlets. His latest work has been about the Obama administration's missed opportunities for diplomacy with Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan. Gareth Porter, welcome.
Thank you.
Just explain the nature of this sort of general diplomatic problem that the Obama administration seems to be having.
I think that is, broadly speaking, correct, that in both Iran and Afghanistan, the difference between the way they're presented and the reality of those conflicts is so big and, you know, basically growing bigger all the time that it really is a matter of propaganda trumping reality in both cases. I mean, in the case of Iran, the propaganda that's trumping reality is that somehow the United States is holding the line by forcing the Iranians to suffer the consequences of United Nations sanctions that it's organizing, that it's determined to prevent Iran from having nuclear weapons. I mean, you know, all of this is so far from the real situation that it's really laughable. And the administration went through this exercise last October down to the present of making it look like they were going to get the Iranians to play their game and they were going to coerce the Iranians diplomatically into giving up their low-enriched uranium. And this was part of this policy of basically the administration showing that it was in control of the situation. And the reality is that they have very little leverage and that the issue itself is really not one of the Iranians wanting to have nuclear weapons. It's merely that they don't want to give up the knowledge that is necessary to have a nuclear weapon, the mastery of the fuel cycle. And in every case, I mean, you know, the reality is so totally different from the propaganda that, you know, you do have essentially a propaganda war going on. In the case of Afghanistan, the propaganda war is mainly coming from General McChrystal, who's trying to make it look like they're on their way to getting control over the situation, just like Petraeus did in Iraq, when the reality is so far from that. It's simply a way of making the U.S. military look good and making McChrystal in particular look good.
You wrote in Interpress, March 21st, about prisoners deemed innocent, ordered released from Bagram Prison, yet only some were released. Just go over the likely consequences of this kind of policy that seems reminiscent of Guantanamo.
Yeah, this is a story that seems to me to illustrate a very fundamental problem that I think people need to understand much more clearly, and that is that the U.S. military, and in this case particularly the Special Operations Forces, which have been operating very freely in Afghanistan, have an unwarranted and unhealthy influence over U.S. policy there. And in this case, we're talking about policy toward the detention of Afghans after they're picked up, in many cases, by the same special forces themselves. And last year, a major general of the U.S. Army, General Douglas Stone, was sent to Afghanistan to study this problem of the detainees being held by the United States and what to do about them. And according to The Guardian, last October, he believed that after his team studied the problem there, at least two-thirds of the roughly 600 detainees who were held at that point in Bagram Air Base facility, a facility that has a terrible reputation for mistreatment of detainees in the past, that two-thirds should have been released because they were innocent, basically that they had been picked up by mistake or simply were so little involved with the insurgency that it didn't make any sense to hold on to them. That report that Major General Stone wrote about the detainee policy in Afghanistan was the basis for an initiative that was decided on last summer to essentially revise the rules or the regulations, the procedures for reviewing the cases of these detainees so that more of them could actually be released. And as a result of that decision, a new task force was created in Kabul to carry out this initiative for the review of these files. But what has happened now is that the new rules are actually weighted heavily in favor of continued detention. If you look at what I was told by the deputy commander of this task force, the rules are still, like the old ones, pretty much favoring the continued detention because the assumption is one of guilt unless the poor detainee is lucky enough to find a way to prove is innocent. Even more important, the commander of this new task force is a Navy admiral, Rear Admiral Harward, who was previously, from 2006 to 2008, he was deputy commander of this secret Task Force 714, a covert black operation being carried out by the Joint Command, which does the special operations in Afghanistan, JSOC, the Joint Special Operations Command. This is a task force that was carrying out hundreds of night raids against targets that they suspected were Taliban or other insurgents, and were obviously generating significant numbers of detainees in the Bagram facility. So here's a man who has a record of being involved in the large-scale detention of Afghans, and now he's back there to oversee this project, this initiative that's supposed to release them. But he doesn't want to see these people go free and to allow them to show there were mistakes made. So there's a real problem here of conflict of interest on the part of these high-ranking officers who were involved in the snatching of these Afghans and their detention.
And the military general you quoted, Major General Douglas Stone, also warning that not releasing these Bagram prisoners will help hardcore Taliban members radicalize detainees in general.
Well, exactly. I mean, the cost of this detention policy the United States has been following in the last few years has, as you've said, clearly resulted in the hardcore Taliban having this wonderful opportunity to radicalize people who were either totally innocent or completely marginal to the movement, you know, had some minor part in it and were swept up. And as a result, obviously, the Taliban are much stronger politically because they have this ready source of new, well-indoctrinated recruits. And it's not just General Stone who said this. General McChrystal himself said the same thing based on that report in his secret initial assessment of last August, which, of course, was leaked to the Washington Post. That's how we know about it. So this is a well-recognized, broadly understood problem, which was the basis, as I said, for this initiative, which seems to be failing as far as the data are able to show, because as I was told by the deputy commander of this task force, only 66 out of 576 have been released. This is 576 detainees whose cases were reviewed since the initiative began. That's only 11% of the total who were reviewed, despite the fact that the idea was supposed to be that most of them should have been released.
We saw what happened in Iraq when the United States military engaged in these mass, you know, home raids in the middle of the night, dragged people out, put hoods over their heads, the families terrified. This led people to be more sympathetic and ultimately to support the resistance.
No doubt about it. I mean, what's happened in Afghanistan is precisely a parallel with what happened in Iraq. And if anything, it might be even worse in Afghanistan in the sense that in Iraq, you had an insurgency that was clearly representing a sectarian group, the Sunnis, who were highly motivated to support the insurgency for all kinds of reasons, not just that the foreign presence was there and that they wanted to expel it, but that they were afraid the United States was going to put a Shia government in power. And of course, they were right, and it turned out that that was precisely what happened, and that the insurgency was their best bet for avoiding what they were afraid would be a Shia government that would mistreat them as they had mistreated the Shia. So there was good reason to believe that the Sunnis very broadly would be supporting that insurgency. In the case of the Taliban, you know, it was much less clear, and I think that this policy of sweeping up hundreds, really thousands over the years of people and detaining them without charge for long periods of time, and in some cases more than 5 years, was certainly a major reason for these people to be highly indoctrinated as supporters of the Taliban.
In December of 2009, President Barack Obama gave a speech at West Point Academy in New York.
And now we must come together to end this war successfully. For what's at stake is not simply a test of NATO's credibility. What's at stake is the security of our allies and the common security of the world.
Not clear that this region has gotten any less dangerous, but it's Hamid Karzai, not President Obama, who is right now making headlines for diplomatic initiatives with the Taliban, his role seeming a bit risky.
I'd say two things about that. One is that it is always very hazardous to get into a war in the first place, no matter how small your commitment is. Anytime the United States uses force in a foreign country, it has very dangerous consequences, and the point is that those consequences are unknown and uncontrollable. The problem is always that you find yourself on a one-way process of escalation in the absence of very great political commitment to reverse it. And I'm afraid that President Obama has not shown thus far the strength of commitment to really reverse that process. Now, you know, one hopes that he does have that. And then the second point I want to make is that I think that he did intend to, at the very least, give himself the option of negotiating a settlement, not so much in March of last year, but in December when he made his speech announcing the escalation, the surge, if you will, of U.S. troops in Afghanistan. I think it's very clear that he intended to give himself that option and that he believed that it might well be necessary to negotiate. He was giving the military 18 months to show progress and saying that after those 18 months, we're going to have to begin a process of exit. Now, of course, he didn't say how long it would take, but let's face it. I mean, this president needs to show the electorate in 2011, as he approaches the presidential election year, that he is indeed in the process of getting out, because he knows it can be very costly to be be involved in a war that's not being won and which has no exit strategy. And that is certainly going to be the case unless he, in fact, begins the negotiating process. So I think, in fact, that that is what he is about to do. I think the chances are that he is going to move towards negotiations. But again, the pressures on the president from the military and their political allies not to negotiate or to put off negotiations is always very intense, and this case is no exception. This is a president who does not have a great deal of confidence in his ability to sell the American people on a policy that is opposed by the military. And that's why, you know, in the case of Iraq, for example, he compromised with the military on a much bigger military presence, certainly than he wanted, for a longer period of time than he wanted. And a military presence, as I reported last year, still is essentially going to be made up after the end of June 2010 of combat brigades. They're not called combat brigades, they're called something else, but that's exactly what he's doing. And that was under pressure from the military, who basically said, we can't abide by, we can't agree with a policy that's not going to give us combat brigades. And so the president had to go along with a scheme that would sort of give them a different label, but still have combat brigades. Now, you know, hopefully that's going to still result in the removal of all combat troops by the end of 2011. So thus far, I'm still optimistic about that. But I'm simply mentioning that because it is a sign that this president is very much inclined to reach a compromise with his military rather than completely countermanding their policy. That's the tendency, I think, and that's what I'm afraid of in the case of Afghanistan as well. He clearly would like to begin negotiations very soon. This has been reported by the New York Times that in a meeting with his National Security Advisors more than a week ago, he said, maybe now is the time for us to begin negotiating with the Taliban, time to initiate talks with the Taliban. And, of course, this was opposed by the Secretary of Defense, the Secretary of State, our favorite hawks in the Obama administration. They wanted to wait until the Kandahar operation, which the U.S. military command, the NATO command, led by General Crystal, is now beginning to gear up for. But that's going to take many, many months. It's not going to be over by any means until well into 2011, and that would mean postponing talks. They would not even begin, basically, until mid-2011, according to this proposal from Secretary Gates and Secretary Clinton. And that would not be in his interest. I think he's going to resist that and insist that talks have to begin sooner. But that's the kind of politics that we face over this question. And, you know, you have to cross your fingers that he's not going to go too far in compromising with the hawks and his administration.
Who is on the U.S. diplomatic team? I mean, there was that strange story recently. Hamid Karzai contacts Mullah Abdul Ghani Baradar, the Taliban leader, who was then promptly arrested. You know, now Karzai reaching out to Baradar again.
Yeah, there are a lot of questions still very murky about how negotiations would in fact unfold, what role the United States would play in them, what role Karzai would play, and indeed how you negotiate with the Taliban leadership. Do you now bypass Baradar, who is in Pakistani hands, or does he still in fact represent Mullah Omar's position, which I think, based on what I learned in Kabul from talking to former Taliban leaders, Taliban officials, Baradar does indeed represent Mullah Omar's position on talks. To the extent that Baradar is identified as one of those who was forward-leaning on negotiations, it represents also Mullah Omar's position as well. The question still is unclear whether the talks could proceed through Mullah Baradar, even though he is in custody in Pakistan, or perhaps as a result of Pakistan reaching an agreement with Karzai in the United States, that he would be provided safe passage to travel to Kabul and set up an office there to negotiate. That's an obvious solution to this problem, and I would not rule it out by any means.
Gareth Porter, what else should the Obama administration be doing on the diplomatic front in Afghanistan?
The first thing that needs to happen is that President Obama has to make a very clear public commitment to peace talks, and it has to include the willingness to negotiate with the representative or representatives of Mullah Omar, who is the spiritual and political leader of the Taliban movement. The idea that the Secretary of Defense and Secretary of State have been pushing that Mullah Omar is somehow unacceptable as a participant in negotiations is simply not viable. You can't have negotiations without recognizing the leadership body of the movement that you're negotiating with. That was really simply an effort to sabotage negotiations. There's no serious distinction to be made between Mullah Omar and the rest of the Taliban. So he has to be very clear about the willingness of the United States to negotiate with the Taliban leadership, and he has to be willing to say, we're going to approve what Karzai requested in the past, which is safe passage for any Taliban leaders who need to travel to Kabul to negotiate or travel to another country. But it's important for him to make that commitment in order to establish the beginning, at least, of some degree of trust on the part of the Taliban leaders as far as the possibility of negotiations.
Does the White House have to stop relying so heavily on these special operation forces, the military in general?
I think that it would be very good if there was clarification here of the role that the military is going to play, that we're not expecting that the military is going to reverse completely the balance of power in Afghanistan. I don't think that the president really did expect that when he made his speech in December. If you really read carefully what he said, he simply said that, you know, it's important to break the momentum of the Taliban. That was, in my view, a signal that he recognized there was going to have to be a negotiated settlement. And for him to say that is not something that the military is going to welcome, because it means that they're fighting in a cause that is not aimed at winning. They know that perfectly well, but they don't want it to be made explicit. But I think that that's what really needs to be done. Whether he's actually going to be willing to do that is another question. Again, the position of power that the military holds in this administration is certainly as great as it's ever been. And I think that the chances that the president is going to sort of make a pronouncement that diminishes the importance of military force while he's negotiating is very unlikely. So I would not hold out much hope for that. I think he's going to sort of continue to support the military notion that what they're doing is very important to give him sort of negotiating leverage over the Taliban. My view is that that doesn't really provide negotiating leverage of any consequence at all, and that the outcome is not going to be affected by this operation in Kandahar for two simple reasons. First, he doesn't have enough troops to make a fundamental difference in terms of the national power balance in Afghanistan. It's simply not going to happen. And two, everyone in Afghanistan really knows the United States is not going to stay for a long, long time. It's not going to happen. The United States is getting out. NATO is getting out. And that means that this military operation is really fundamentally meaningless. It's not going to make any difference. But the military and the president, in a way, are stuck with their pronouncements in the past. So therefore, they have to play out this sort of play-acting that the military operation in Kandahar and beyond is somehow going to make a huge difference in the outcome in Afghanistan.
What about the financial factors involved in all of this?
First of all, I don't think that there is a financial solution to the conflict in Afghanistan. I mean, it's not going to turn on financing. It's going to turn on politics, the ethnic politics of Afghanistan, the enormous power of the Pashtun people in Afghanistan. They are not a majority, but the largest single ethnic group in Afghanistan. President Karzai is a Pashtun himself. He clearly is motivated by the very, very powerful desire for peace and reconciliation that most of the Pashtun policy has expressed clearly to him and to other members of his family to make peace with the Taliban. That is going to happen one way or another, sooner or later. So I think that's the basic reality that we face. I think the financial assistance that the United States is giving essentially to the Pakistani military, most of it going to the military, is really a big part of the politics of that part of the world. But it's not going to really do much to shape the outcome of Afghanistan, in my view. What it does do is to give the United States this continued position of basically trying to curry favor with the Pakistani military in the hope that somehow Pakistani military is going to be more on our side than it has been in the past. That, of course, always has been and still is an illusion. It's not going to work because the Pakistani military is motivated first and foremost by its view that its national security problem is 99 and 99/100% India. And so all of the military assistance that the United States gives to Afghanistan is not going to tilt it any further in a direction that the United States wants it to go. It's going to continue to carry out a policy that is aimed primarily at defending itself against India, and that, of course, means supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan.
What about U.S. dollars to select Taliban? What's that doing?
This is very interesting. I mean, Jacob Diliberto of the Organization of Veterans has been in Afghanistan, just came back, and I spoke with him this morning about his conversation with the head of the peace and reconciliation team of the Karzai administration. And it's interesting that he was told that they don't really need money from the United States. That's not what they need to carry out reconciliation. What they need is for the United States to stop its combat operations in Afghanistan. This is coming from Karzai's guy trying to win over the Taliban, trying to arrange for hundreds, thousands of individual Taliban and groups of Taliban to come back into the fold. He was told that if the U.S. stopped its combat operations, they could make peace with the Taliban within 6 months.
As you know, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is in Washington for the AIPAC meetings and for talks with the White House. What should the president tell Netanyahu?
Well, he should tell Netanyahu the United States will not support Israel unless they make some very, very sharp changes in their policy. And as I think the rhetoric has it in U.S. policy, show some minimal regard for or respect for the legitimate interests of the Palestinians. That's really the key. What we need from the Israeli government is a demonstration that they respect the legitimate interests of the Palestinians. This government does not do that. Previous governments have not done it. This government does it even less. And that should be the talisman, that should be the criterion that the U.S. government uses to judge Israeli policy. And to the extent that Israeli policy refuses to do that, the United States ought to be speaking out and acting on that to put pressure on Israel using all the instruments that it has to do so. And it does have significant instruments to do it, which have not been used.
At one time, there was discussion, you know, would Israel attack Iran or, you know, that kind of thing?
Well, you know, there's a story that is really not well understood, and I'm going to be writing sometime in the next several weeks, I'm not sure exactly when, having to do with this whole question of the Israelis threatening to attack Iran, attack its nuclear program. The reality is it has been fixed U.S. policy for a very, very long time that if Israeli warplanes go through airspace that is controlled by the United States, and that includes, of course, the airspace of Iraq, through which Israeli warplanes really need to travel in order to get to Iran to carry out that kind of operation, they will be shot down unless the Israelis have the secret codes that are necessary to alert the United States that friendly warplanes are going through, that have been given permission to go through that airspace. Israel has requested those secret codes. The Bush administration refused. The chances that this administration will turn over those secret codes to the Israelis, I think, are very, very vanishingly small. So I think that the possibility that the Obama White House is going to make it possible for the Israelis to attack Iran going through the airspace that they would need to travel through Iraq, is practically non-existent.
Gareth Porter, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on, Tori.
You can read Gareth Porter's stories online at Interpress Service and other news outlets, and we'll link to a collection of them on our website. Gareth Porter is author of 4 books, including his recent Perils of Dominance, Imbalance of Power, and The Road to War in Vietnam. For Talk Nation Radio, I'm Dori Smith. This program is produced in Storrs, Connecticut, and syndicated with Pacifica Network. TalkNationRadio.org is our website. TalkNationRadio@gmail.com if you'd like to write to us. Our music is by Fritz Heed, fritzheed.com.